You'll remember last week we got into the nature of creation, that God is an excessive creator, that creation itself is excessive in the sense that it's not necessary, that God creates because he wants to, not because he needs to. And then we got at the tail end of that into redemption, that God redeems not because he has to or is compelled to, but because he desires to, simply because he loves us. And so this week, we want to look at what is our response to that? What are we to do if creation is like this, if God is like this? What is at least in part some of our response? And you'll remember that we talked about the reason we want to go through this for the next several weeks and then beyond is because a lot of what we do as a church, both ministry, philosophy-wise, and so forth, is built on these presuppositions. And so I want you to see them. This week is going to kind of be a little bit of a shotgun blast, but then we'll break these down in the weeks to come. So hang on. And the title of this particular lesson is Enjoy the Good for Goodness Sake. Nietzsche wrote these words: Christianity wants to destroy, shatter, stun, and intoxicate. There's only one thing it does not want: moderation. And for this reason, it is in its deepest meaning barbaric, Asiatic, ignoble, and un-Greek. And hopefully we'll know what that means by the end of this. And then Charles Simeon wrote these words: Enjoy God in everything, and everything in God. So one of the things I want us to talk about today is simply this: that enjoying creation is part of our calling as people made in God's image. And enjoying creation should, if done rightly, increase our love and appreciation for God, and not the other way around. You know, depending, again, as we talked about, your background and how you were raised, a lot of times we hear the word worldliness, we think of the world, and then, you know, we're afraid of all the things in the world, right? You know, don't drink and or smoke or chew and those sorts of things. You know, depending on what kind of youth groups you went to as a child, in our youth group, you know, there were two topics. Drinking would be one week, and then, you know, premarital sex would be the next week, and then they would play, you know, a different Amy Grant or Michael W. Smith song back-to-back to kind of reinforce the point. But it was definitely this overwhelming sense of Christianity was a religion that was a thou shalt not in the main. Avoid these things. They may seem good, they may seem very attractive, but they're bad. And again, as we learned last week, nothing in creation in and of itself is bad. It's how we use it that goes wrong, right? To the pure, all things are pure. But to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, and so forth. Augustine wrote this: He loves thee too little who enjoys not thy gifts, which thou hast given to enlarge our minds and expand our hearts and enrich our souls and increase our strength, that we might love thee fully and supremely and expansively forever. So first we can summarize as saying this: if God said in the creation, let there be too much of the good stuff, if God is excessive in that way, if he's not practical and he's not thrifty, he's not efficient, he's not balanced, you know, we talked about the stars in the heavens that, you know, man will never see, and yet he knows them all by name, you know, parts of his creation that no one has encountered that he has created simply because he delights in it. You know, he is not thrifty or economical in the way that we think of it, in the way that he creates. He is lavish and extreme, and he goes to great excess. And we talked about the fact that he not only is excessive, but that he delights, that he loves first, and he has reasons, if you will, second. You know, that. So, for instance, he loves us, and the because of in that sentence is what? Why does God love us? Because he wants to. So notice, in and of himself, it's simply because he desires to. He has desires, not reasons. So, you know, if there's a reason, I love you because, you know, you're handsome or you're tall or you're smart or you're righteous, that love is conditional, right? Conditioned upon if you stay smart, beautiful, righteous, and so forth, which none of us do. Since the fall, that's just not going to happen. But he loves us simply because he wants to love us, and that in and of itself is part of his delight. But we are not in that way since the fall like God. You and I have become moderates. You know, and especially if you look at the history of Western philosophy, our sensibilities, kind of built on the stiff back of Greek ideals, have been shaped from the very beginning by this idea of moderation. You know, moderation, in one sense, is the highest form of piety, if you look at Greek philosophy on. We like to believe in things like the middle way about everything, right? The via media, you know, not too much, not too little, everything just right down the center. You know, we're like Goldilocks, you know, not too soft, not too hard, it's just right. And that's how we go about living our lives a lot of time, or at least we're programmed to live our lives. You know, we teach our kids, for instance, not to scream, or our boys not to cry. And even as we grow into adulthood, we as Americans, you rarely or seldomly see people truly weeping at funerals, you know. We're almost not even allowed to anymore. It has to be a celebration of life. You know, the idea of, you know, grief is not even allowed in our culture. You rarely see people laugh uncontrollably, and which is strange because if you look at our North American life, for all of its gross gluttony, all of its technological lust, all of its processed, you know, pornography and its sanctioned narcissism that is now, you know, stamped with approval. We, at the end of it all, are not a place of too much, but far too little. And that's really what I want us to get out of this series, that our problem is that isn't that we want things too much and we enjoy things too much. It's that we have no idea what to desire. We don't desire those things nearly enough, and we don't enjoy them nearly enough once we, you know, even get prone to desire them. But that's not how it was intended. We were not made to be moderates or to water down all of God's truths to some sort of tempered, lukewarm middle. We were made to be fat-souled, whole-souled people. We were made to image our Maker. If He is excessive, if He loves supremely, right? You know, if there's no depths or ends to His love, you know, He doesn't love in some moderate way, you know. I'll love you if you do X, Y, and Z. He loves, and then He keeps on loving, and He keeps on loving even after you've done plenty of things that would seem to require Him ceasing that love. When we are faithless, He still remains faithful because He can't deny Himself. And He decided in Himself that He was going to love you eternally. We were made to love well and cry hard and laugh harder and to believe things, to truly believe things as if our life depended on them, and then to talk and to live as if we believed that statement, right? Which is hard in our culture. It's hard to believe anything or any kind of truth in a way that you say, I'm going to stand here and really not move from this position. I believe this so fully that it's going to change the way I talk to people and live my life. You know, everything in our culture is somewhat movable, and you don't want to be too extreme about anything. And if you are extreme, you know, it takes on the Alex Jones sort of extreme, not, you know, if you don't get that reference, it's okay, you're not missing much. As author Paul Ramsey writes, the Christian ideal of character is not the same as the Greek ideal, which is in nothing too much and something of everything. Aristotle's ethic of the mean is not the same as Jesus' ethic of the extreme. I mean, think of what Jesus says. You know, if you don't love if you don't hate father and mother and brother and sister because of me, then you don't have any part in me. You know, statements like that, we think, well, you know, Jesus didn't really mean what he was saying there, right? And we go about our normal goal in preaching those texts is to explain why that really didn't mean anything much at all, right? That you don't have to not love anybody or, you know, deny anybody. But Christ makes some pretty extreme statements, because he believes that joining up with his mission and becoming connected to his kingdom and life really is a huge ordeal that requires everything from us. Chesterton puts it this way, the church has always had a healthy hatred of pink. It hates the combination of two colors, which is the feeble expedition of the philosophers. We have come to believe that you can have too much of a good thing. This is a blasphemous belief, which at one blow wrecks all the heavens that men have hoped for. Why does he say that? Why does he say that the idea of you can have too much of a good thing ruins all the heavens that we've hoped for? Yeah, I mean, heaven will be, the beatific vision will be us trying to embrace and behold a God who is infinite and inexhaustible for all eternity, right? And we will never say too much, right? That's enough of that. Let's move on to something else. Our whole existence in the new creation will be inexhaustible because God's beauty and glory and goodness are inexhaustible. And we will never tire of knowing and wanting to know him. You know, can God, for instance, can we have too much of a good thing? To say we can is to undo God himself. Can God love too much? We would never say that. Can we love God too much? You know, is it possible to say, well, you just need to calm down, you know, you love God too much? We don't hear that often around here. Can you be too kind or too just or too joyful or too alive? You know, these are things that I think we would say in one sense, no, you can't be too much of that. But the way that we live our lives, we definitely are always shading certain things so that we don't get too extreme in one way or the other. Temperance, therefore, as Christians, is not the great goal. All right, now hear me here. Temperance is not the great goal. Excess is the goal. And as we talked about even in our study in virtues a while back, temperance is only and always in service to being excessive about the right things. So, for instance, you know, Augustine would say, we're temperate when it comes to, you know, pursuing different sorts of lusts and desires in order that we can give ourselves fully to things that are better than those things, you know. So you use certain things in moderation so that you can give yourselves in everything to something that's more worthy of all of your attention. So that love might give itself entirely, he writes, and without restraint to that which is loved, there can never be too much love for God, nor too little of the impulses which impede it. So he's saying, if anything's stopping you from loving God, be temperate with those things. But as far as the other things, be as excessive as you can be, right? So you only hold back in certain areas so you can give yourself fully in others. So if all of that's true, if God is excessive, if God's not a moderate, if he has loves, not desires, and if God is calling us to image him, what does this call us as people made in his image to do? I mean, how are we to interact with and how are we to embrace the world which he has created and then the maker of that world? Well, I would say in just one response, the bottom line answer to that question is to enjoy the gift. That really is your calling. Now, we'll talk in the weeks to come what that means and what that looks like, but that really is the answer to the question. If God has given you a gift that's good and excessive, if it's good and true and beautiful, if it images him, then what he wants you to do is enjoy the thing he's given, not to avoid it. So the first thing that we can do, what does that mean, though? What does it mean to enjoy the gift? We're going to fly through a few of these, and then, again, we'll revisit them in weeks to come. First thing I would say is that we're to look up. We're to look up, or that's another way of saying that he calls us to be thankful. You know, the radical givenness of being, you know, that you exist. I mean, just get a hold of that for one second. You exist. You do not have to exist. but here you are, and you open, you know, your eyes and your lungs in this world in such a way that everything you receive really is received. You bring nothing. Even your generation was not your idea, right? Your conception wasn't your idea. And you enter a world where you realize, I am needy from the jump, right? If mom doesn't pick me up and feed me, I die, right? You know, if someone doesn't clothe me or change me, you know, I'm not going to last long. And there's this reality that God builds into us as humans that reinforces this idea. You are a needy person constantly being given free gifts in order that you can survive and exist and ultimately, you know, as you grow and mature, to flourish in this world. So the radical givenness of this life demands that I look up to the giver. It demands that in all of my relationship to people and things, I begin with gratitude, including my relationship to the seemingly mundane things of life. Things like food and drink. So, you know, the idea of, like, does the Bible require that you pray before meals, you know? Is there, you know, well, it's not that a certain prayer is required, but it's the reality that you're about to receive sustenance that you didn't think of, you didn't create, that's good, and therefore, at the very base level, you should be thankful. Now, the best way to be thankful, or at least the most habitually best way to train yourself to be thankful, is to articulate your thanksgiving, right? To put words to these feelings, hopefully, that you have. If you want to know your role in the story, if you want to know your job in this creation, gratitude is nearly the sum and substance of it. That God puts you on this earth to be grateful to him as the giver and maker of all things. I mean, you may think that sounds like an overstatement, or maybe that doesn't sound like much. So, you know, in one sense, like, the whole thing is to be grateful, and then you may think, like, well, that's my only job. I think I'm a little bit more important than that. Just remember, you didn't need to be here anyway. So, you know, we aren't vital to the story. You know, God is without us, and he will be if we are not here. And so the fact that we are really is just a miracle of God's kindness. But hear what the scripture says with regard to thanksgiving. He speaks about some ascetics in the church. They forbid marriage, they require abstinence from food that God created. He created it to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Now listen to this. For everything created by God is good. That should sound like something we talked about last week. And nothing is to be rejected. That's a pretty big statement. I would not have said that, 20 years ago and meant it. There's all kinds of things we shouldn't receive. If it's received with thanksgiving. So notice, everything is good. Nothing is to be rejected. The one condition is what? That you're grateful in the reception. And that becomes key. I mean, that really tells us the story of the Bible, is that the difference between worship and idolatry is right there. Now, that may not be self-evident, but we'll see how that looks here in a second. Paul says the same thing, right, in Romans 1:20. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, and how does he say they knew them? How did they know God, according to him in that verse? Because he was evident in the things he made. So he said, like, they kept running into God because everywhere in his creation, even down to the smallest things, he's showing forth his kindness and his attributes of power and so forth. And he says, seen since the creation of the world and the things they've made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God. And how does he articulate that? Or give thanks to him. So how do they not honor God? Because he was everywhere in the things he made, and they didn't say thank you. They weren't grateful in the reception of those things or in their interaction with those things. Man comes into the world into which everything is offered to man as a gift, and every gift that is offered is a reflection of the giver. So get your head around that. You wake up in the garden. let's pretend, God isn't there communicating immediately. You realize, whoa, I am. I exist. And there's all this stuff here. I didn't put it here, right? And the stuff that's there is showing you somebody. The first thing that, the Bible says you should do is say, thank you. Or appreciate those things, knowing that you're not the one who sourced them. All that is exists is freely given by God. We established that last week. And all of it reveals God. I mean, think of that. That shouldn't surprise us too much, because what is creation at the end of the day? How is creation? How did it come to be? He spoke it. So what is creation made of? It's made of words, right? I mean, even when scientists break it all down, they get to atoms and they get to quarks and they're like, well, what is a quark? Like, yeah, we don't know. Just, pretend that we can understand what that is. We just know it's just really small. But behind it all, the kind of the why and how, the Bible says his words have made everything. And it shouldn't surprise us then if those are his words, then they say something about him, right? They reveal something about him. I mean, Calvin was big on this, that, you can know God by his word, and you can know by God by creation, that both speak of him clearly. The only problem is, we have, broken glasses. We don't read the things rightly. But it's not because the revelation isn't clear. It's that our minds are muddled. Our eyes are foggy. The very thing reveals the maker himself. And not only is it his word, it's all blessed by God. He's spoken a benediction over everything he's made. Everything is very good. So a gift that is good from a giver who is good, and we are part of that blessed creation. And yet, of all of that creation, there's only one creature that is expected to mimic God by blessing him for the blessing. Okay? So in the middle of his world, he puts a man. And the role that that man has is to take of the creation and then look up, right, and be thankful for it. So where the circle is complete, you know, God makes, he bends down and he makes. Man opens his hand and receives, and as he receives, he looks back up and blesses the one who has blessed him. So that is our role in the creation that makes us differ radically from any other creature. You know, the Psalms will talk about, you know, the lion, you know, knows who provides for it. But, you know, it's not the lion's, you know, sits and gives his, you know, daily prayer before he, you know, eats the hyena or whatever else he's taking out at any given moment. You know, they're animals and they're not sinful if they don't say grace, right? But man who receives and has no thought of his maker or uses things for his own ends, that man is guilty because he has a role in the world that's been instituted by God. It's part of what he's made for. So think of the fall. And think of what's going on there. There's one food in all of creation that's not given. I mean, think, there are things that, you know, do blow my mind. It doesn't surprise me because I know my own heart, but it does blow my mind still that there was only one no in the whole world that Adam was made in. Everywhere he looked just screamed yes, right? Everything was open for business. There was only one close sign anywhere, and that was on the one tree that God spoke over. That was the only thing that God said, this is not a blessing for you. You won't be blessed by partaking of this. To eat of this tree, then, would be the only thing in creation that would be a one-way street. Because it would solely be for the purpose of the user. If you're going to partake of that tree, you're obviously not honoring the one who made it because it's the only thing that he said, don't partake of. It would end, you'll notice, that grand circle of God giving, me receiving with thanksgiving, and giving blessing back to God. It would just be me taking for taking's sake and pleasuring for an end in myself, right? You know, if you will, the creation ends and begins with me. I'm all that matters, which is, unfortunately, idolatry at its base, you know. We look out for other gods, but we want gods that will ultimately honor and prop up our designs, right? Which is why we... You know, oh, you give that, then I'll worship you as long as you give me what I want, which is, again, you know, the root of idolatry. The grand circle from a blessed God blessing man so that he might bless the blessed God would have been a dead end in this transaction if it was partaken of. It is using the world and loving the world for itself without any relation for the revealed God that made the world. Right, so the world that you're using, we already said, reveals God in all of its use. But to use it and say, I want to ignore the God part of this, I just want the thing, is at its heart idolatry. This, unfortunately, is commonplace now. Our natural dependence on the world and the things of the world, oddly, was never meant to drive us away from God, but always and only to him. We were to recognize him in everything. And yet we have been unable, because of our sinfulness, to continue in that. I mean, I think one of the big tactics that the devil has taught us from the garden on is that God's a miser, right? I mean, what did the tempter say to Adam and Eve? Yeah, did he really say that? And what was he implying? What was God's intention for them not eating of it? Yeah, there's something so good over here, and he's just a tightwad, you know? He doesn't want you to have this good thing. When the whole creation was screaming that he wanted you to have good things, right? And so notice, the Satan still does that with the world. When God tells us this is the proper use of something, Satan's favorite tactic is he just doesn't understand, or he just doesn't want you to enjoy the good stuff. When the opposite is actually true, he wants you to enjoy the good in the best way possible. And yet we're too foolish and blind often to do so. One author writes this concerning gratitude. Gratitude is a cornerstone of most spiritual traditions. But gratitude just doesn't sit organically with me as part of this process. I am very clear that I am the creator. And I'm one of those folks who have created every single thing on their wish list in a short period. I mean, a bit self-indulgent, but we'll continue. I celebrate it. I delight in it. But I don't feel appreciation or gratitude for any of it any more than I feel gratitude for my own arm, which apparently he made. It just is. It's just simply what I'm up to. The element of gratitude feels like asking and receiving from a source outside of you. If I were a baker making many cakes a day instead of manifestations, I would take a new cake out of the oven. I wouldn't take a new cake out of the oven and have gratitude for it. I know that if I mix the ingredients, put it in, take it out, there will be a cake there, one that I made. I can do and acknowledge that the whole process is pretty groovy, but again, gratitude for receiving always feels to me that I'm thanking an entity outside of myself. Notice for the author, no thanksgiving is needed for any of his accomplishments, his life, the process, his arm, because he put in the time and he gets the reward. It's just a simple equation. This is how the world works. It would be silly, you know, to be grateful for the process. It's silly to be grateful for your own arm, an arm that he apparently sprouted and crafted by his own hard work and determination. It just shows, these kind of quotes, the folly of idolatry. Letting the credit end with the creature is one of the most blind and obvious things, that as if we can all make it on our own, or that we've added all that's needed for the process of life. The very opposite is true. One of my favorite quotes from Chesterton, he says, "Children are grateful when Santa Claus puts in their stockings gifts of toys or sweets. Could I not be grateful to Santa Claus that he put in my stockings the gift of two miraculous legs? We thank people for birthday presents of cigars and slippers. Can I thank no one for the birthday present of birth?" You know, so notice what Chesterton's saying. He's saying, like, how do you not just open your eyes and I'm putting on my socks and I should be saying thank you. Why? Well, because I have legs. You know, where did those come from? Those weren't my idea. You know, very different from the man who says, you know, I just look at my arm and it's just like everything else. You know, something I did with my own power. Notice the same action can either be a glorious response to God the giver, or according to the Bible, the most vile act of idolatry. The same action, right? So baking a cake, that's not the issue, right? But the issue is baking a cake with gratitude, or baking a cake as if, you know, you are the you know, creator of your own fate, you know, the Invictus sort of reality. You know, the worst moment for an atheist is when he is really thankful and has no one to thank. And since God made it all, and since you encounter God in everything, there is absolutely nothing for which you cannot be grateful. Okay, so God gave everything, and God is present. He's made himself manifest in everything. So anything you encounter is cause for thanksgiving. I'm going to use Chesterton to death on this one, but he's pretty good on this subject. You say grace before meals? All right. But I say grace before the play and the opera, and grace before the concert and the pantomime, grace before I open a book, and grace before sketching, boxing, walking, playing, dancing, grace before I dip the pen in the ink. Our first call as creatures made in God's image is simply gratitude. But we see that gratitude is not easily ginned up for grown folks who feel like they've accomplished something. So the second thing we need to see after looking up, and this is where we'll have to end today because I went way longer than I should have, is growing down, which in other words is if we're looking up toward God, we will become like children in the right way. You know, children understand all is a miracle. Children by nature are filled with wonder. And this is something that, you know, we call at times growing up. You know, I've lost all my wonder for the world. I've become, you know, sarcastic and jaded. You know, nothing excites me anymore, you know, because I'm a grown man. And the Bible just says that's wrong, right? That the world really is full of wonder because it's full of the God who made it. And part of our job is to receive that world, to have eyes that receive it for what it is as perpetual gift and display of God's goodness, and to be filled with wonder. It is surprising, if we're called to be grateful and full of wonder at God and his world and our dependence on it, that Jesus said to become like children. And the younger we get in that regard, according to the Bible, the better. Again, a child of 7 is excited by being told that Tommy opened the door and saw a dragon. But a child of three is excited by being told that Tommy opened a door. if you ever hung out with small children, you get this, right? You know, in Chesterton, again, in chapter four of Orthodoxy, The Ethics of Elfland, great chapter if you've never read it, well worth your time, writes this concerning kids. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exalt a monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exalt monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun. And every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but he has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. You know, Chesterton looking at the creation and speaking to, you know, the scientific determinist that just says the world is a machine, and it's obvious that it's a machine because no personal God would have the sun, you know, rising day after day, you know. At best, he set it in motion and walked away. And Chesterton's saying, no, God has the appetite of a child. In the sense that he is so full of delight that he never gets tired of doing the same thing over and over again. And we know that to be true even in the gospel, right? His mercies are new every morning. He never says after, you know, the 77th time or the 70 times 7th time, okay, I've had enough, right? The mercy thing was fun for a while, but you're ridiculous. And we're grateful that God is like that, right? When it comes to ourselves, we're grateful that his love is unconditional and untiring and, you know, he's unfatigued and he's calling us to be the same sort of people in the world. How do we then grow down? I mean, if that's what we're supposed to be like, how can we possibly kind of aim our sights, if you will, to become more childlike? I think it begins what we've discussed a bit already. You must believe, you know, in your core that you're not necessary, but you're here. That God really has gifted you not only creation, but as you sit here this morning, redemption, which is, something all the more glorious, that after we had come to his creation, you know, and as one author writes, you know, we got, flour all over the kitchen, that he still was pleased, you know, to come and find us and deliver us. God doesn't need you to complete himself. And as wonderful as you are a luxury. So, you know, to get a hold of that and to believe it. But the second thing with that is that we're not worthy. We're here, but even in that we did not do well, and yet God has freely gifted us salvation and has not been a miser in the way that he's distributed that. You know, think of the tasks we're given and how we've fouled them up. Our sin even now shows the hopelessness of us being the ones that will get the job of new creation done. We've pretty much made that obvious throughout the, you know, human history, that God's going to have to do something to right what we have wronged. And he has in Christ, and he will fully and finally in Christ. You know, our works now won't get us back to the garden. They won't get us forward to heaven. In fact, something we're going to get into later, God doesn't need our works at all. He just doesn't need them. Jesus did all the work necessary to bring about the new creation. And yet, you're going to be invited into the very works of Jesus. Again, as a, if you will, superfluous, an extra, an extravagant way of God allowing us to be a part of what he's doing in the world. These two facts taken together mean that in the big story of the universe, I'm going to say this, and we're going to hopefully still be friends at the end of it, you're really not that big of a deal. you know, that you weren't necessary, and yet you're here, and then when you got here, you messed up, which means that the story can't possibly be all about you. If it was, it's going to be a bad story, right? The ending is going to be poor. That the story is first and foremost from God, of God, and about God, and in that sense, it gives you complete permission to get over yourself, right? That you, if you don't get things right tomorrow, God's not nervous, right? And the whole ship's not going down. That God really is in control of all things, including your little patch of the garden. I remember toward the close of The Hobbit, when Bilbo was remarking of the effects that the journey has had on him, He's talking to Gandalf, and he makes a comment, and Gandalf says, "You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck, just for your sole benefit? You are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I am very fond of you. But you're only quite a little fellow in the wide world, after all." To which Bilbo rightly responds, and this is where this whole series is headed, "Thank goodness," Bilbo said, laughing, and he handed him the tobacco jar. In one sense, that is the right response to the, "You're not that big of a deal. Well, good, then I can just relax, right? Here, pass me the pipe." You know, just to do something to realize that it's not all your angst that's going to get God's work done in the world. It's your receiving his goodness and living, we'll see, out of that goodness toward others that will get God's work done in the world. We're going to pretend that's a real clean place to end. Now, we're going to finish this point, and then we'll start next week. The only thing more impish than the person who cannot perceive what things should be taken seriously is the one who takes everything seriously, or worse, takes themselves really seriously. You ever met someone that just, they're convinced that they're a really, really big deal? No one likes to be around that, right? And it's interesting, as we'll see, what God does require of us, which the great commandment is love. This sort of activity is the one thing that usually chops love off at the very beginning, when you really think that you are the most important thing that's going on in the room. You know, Chesterton writes, "Angels can fly because they take themselves lightly." Now, how do we know if we've done this? How do we know if we've taken ourselves too seriously? Well, business comes before life and family. Work assumes an importance in terms of salary and benefits rather in terms of enjoyment and service and vocation. Making a name for oneself holds a higher priority than living at peace with your family and with your neighbor. Going to a prestigious college outweighs the saving of one's soul. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's ways that you can tell if you've done this. And it's, am I trading in the good things of God for the, you know, mess of pottage that this world is offering me, you know, status and a name and importance? If those are the things that all of your attentions are aiming for, you've missed, you know, you've missed the plot. You know, you're going in the wrong direction. And if you can put aside some of those things for the sake of the, you know, the 3-year-old in the room, or for, you know, that ailing, you know, parent next to you, then you begin to realize these are the sorts of things that life is really made of, because this is the way that God has treated us. You know, he has come to us in our time of need. If we cease to see the world as wonderful and give thanks, these are the ways that we can tell that we have grown too old. We must grow down in order to be thankful, because it helps our eyes to look up as we're receiving everything as gift.